Welcome to Creative Maine, an hour-long monthly program produced for and broadcast by WERU 89.9 FM Blue Hill, Maine, and at weru.org. This show considers the making of craft, fine art, food, literature, music, dance, museums, and any other form of creative expression here in Maine. We also discuss topics of global cultural significance and interest. My name is Adina Salmonson, and I am your host for this monthly exploration of all things creative. Should you have comments, questions, input, or suggestions for the show, send them to info@weru.org. Please list Creative Maine in the subject line. The life of the arts is a test of the quality of a nation's civilization, said JFK. As a lifelong musician and crafter, I am thrilled to be presenting my areas of interest and passion to you on our wonderful community radio station right here in my Orland backyard. On today's show, we showcase three organizations that encourage emerging talent in the arts world. I chat with Dr. Beth Wieman, UMaine Professor and President of the Society of Composers, Chantal Harris, Director of Artist Residency Program Monson Arts, and Mark Mushaw, Executive Director of another very different Maine Artist Residency Program, Hewn Oaks. Welcome, Dr. Beth Wieman, to Creative Maine. I'm so glad you could come on with us today and talk about some very exciting things coming up at the University of Maine regarding the Society of Composers and its upcoming conference. So introduce yourself and tell us the role you play in the Society of Composers, a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you came to be involved with the Society of Composers and the University of Maine.
So I'm Beth Wieman. I'm a composer and clarinet player, and I teach music theory and composition and clarinet at the University of Maine, where this conference is being held. I'm also a member of the Society of Composers and have been for a very long time, decades, I think. And I've had different roles in the organization, one of which was the chair of Region 1, which used to be New England. So I shared that with a couple people at different times, and now we're actually putting some regions together within this Society of Composers, which is a national organization. It's really a service organization, a professional organization for composers. The main population, I think, of the membership has traditionally been people who were teaching music in some way and also were composers. So it's not, we don't have as much membership within what we call the commercial composer population. We have some, and we have some people who are freelance multimedia artists of different kinds and maybe teach that as well as just what we consider sort of conservatory type music. But we have tried to become more open to people who are not just university folks.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so the conference that we have coming up has a combination of some university folks from different kinds of departments, some from media departments, from music departments, coming in, sometimes bringing guest performers with them, sometimes having their pieces played by University of Maine performers. A couple people are going to have their pieces played by Syracuse University performers. So it's a range of different things. We have things that are what we call sometimes art songs, you know, sort of solo singers and accompaniment. We have chamber music, including trombone quartet, which I believe you are part of.
Yes.
And then we also have choral music and electronic music. So we have some things with electronic video and stuff like that. So it's a smorgasbord, and we have 6 concerts over 2 days.
Wow, that's a lot of new music. So what I'd like to do is define and maybe clarify a couple of things for our listeners. People in general tend to lump all non-pop music under the label classical music. But that's a misnomer in so many ways. Can you explain what classical music actually is and what it isn't, and what you would call the music produced by Society of Composer members?
Even now, it's all shifting, right? So we've had trouble, because people use the phrase classical music to mean pretty much anything that's being performed by an ensemble that they associate with classical music. So if you say orchestra, people automatically say classical. Or if you say choir, oftentimes people would say, unless you say jazz choir, and then they have a different view of what's happening. Some people have tried to sort of substitute the phrase like concert music, but that doesn't actually work, right? Because lots of people give concerts. So, and we don't all call them necessarily classical music. I think one of the things that tends to happen more in classical music than it does in other genres of music is that it gets written down more. You can make a case that some kinds of jazz compositions also have a lot of notation involved with it. And there's like also, movie music obviously is written down so that it can be played by groups of people. But the notation of a lot of the composers on this particular conference, they're really trying to write things for performers to be able to do when the composer isn't there, right? You want to give enough information in what those performers are looking at on paper, although now mostly PDF on an iPad, honestly, because that's a little bit more portable. You want to get as much information so that people don't get quite too many questions about, well, how is this really supposed to sound, especially if I can't find a recording of it, because maybe that recording hasn't been commercially released, even if it's been performed before. The people in this group tend to be more about, I'm going to be writing music that other people can play, not just me. Whereas a lot of pop composers, some of whom are actually, quite skilled in terms of harmonic progression and all that stuff that we teach at a music school, and many of them did actually go to music school, but they're not worried so much about having somebody play the music besides themselves, or it's not top of mind for them. One of them.
When I think of classical music, I think of Mozart, right? And that's a period of composition time. So people in our day and age who are not dead white men, right? They're people who write music are all ages, genders, colors, nationalities, everybody in the world. What would you call that? You said concert music, but that doesn't
Yeah,
really
I mean,
fit.
again, we don't have a great word for it, but then people wind up saying contemporary music, which becomes meaningless. The other thing that I think that you have to come at it from the other point of view is that it's gotten to the point where we're less worried about putting up guardrails around the kind of music that various performers play, particularly on what you would call, let's say, recital programs. The minute you say the word recital, right, you sort of means that it's going to be more serious or something. But there's lots of people who play a smorgasbord of stuff on their chamber music recitals. So you'll see people playing Brahms, and then they'll actually be playing Piazzolla, right? Which is Astor Piazzolla. And that's become the norm, that you don't necessarily put up boundaries as much. Now, are they going to play things like, I mean, I've certainly heard people play variations on Beatles stuff. It's a little bit hard to give it one name when it's all these different kinds of things. I was telling somebody a couple weeks ago that I went to a different conference by an organization that only does electronic music. So you would have thought that since that's like a genre, like even within the big genre that we're talking about, that there would be a lot of things that would be the same. But it was still split into kind of like different subgenres. So there would be a genre that was mostly variations and filtered things with noise. So a whole piece about I'm filtering this kind of noise that I got from a mechanical machine, and I'm making it sound different ways during the whole piece. Maybe another person would be saying, no, I'm actually doing things so that it's more like the kind of a magical harpsichord that could do things that a regular harpsichord couldn't do. But I'm going to write music for this magic super harpsichord. That applies also to even to things that are going to be less, more, let's say, open than just electronic music. So our conference is going to have things that sound not Mozart-y exactly, but let's say more traditional.
Okay.
And then there's also going to be stuff that doesn't sound traditional at all.
Okay.
So this would be more like if you had a pop station that allowed itself to play experimental pop and regular pop, and you kind of go, is this all pop? I don't know. This is not what I think of as pop. But the same thing happens in classical music, just like popular music has sort of like got little subgenres that you could go look up on Bandcamp and say, oh, this is supposed to be Americana, which is different from country, right? And make the same kind of little judgment buckets for the different genres of people writing. I'm considered, I think, out there among my colleagues, kind of not terribly conservative, but not terribly experimental. So I'm sort of middle of the road. So I'm not going to be writing a piece that's filtered noise.
Gotcha.
There are
Okay.
people who will. So
Yeah.
I didn't really answer the question because I don't think there's a good word.
There isn't a good word. So introduce us to some of the composers represented at this conference.
We have, because of our regions, we have a bunch of people from New York and we have a bunch of people from New England. And then we have some other visitors from further afield, from Idaho and I think Arizona and Florida and other people who have actually, they submitted their works and were selected by our performers and other composers on the SCI board. Who's coming? There's 30 people coming. So I'm the 30th, so I'm represented, and there's some people from the University of Maine system represented as well. Richard Nelson is coming with a Maine group called the Resonosa Ensemble, which is a great group, which is soprano, cello, and piano, and they're a group of freelance performers in Maine, and they've built their own repertoire of stuff. So that's going to be like a 15-minute song cycle he's bringing. We have various people were selected for the University of Maine choral group called the University Singers. So they're singing a few pieces on the last concert. The Euphony Chamber Choir is going to sing the last concert on Friday. This is a Friday Saturday event on February 21st, 22nd. So those people were all submitting pieces that, you know, the choral director decided these are idiomatic. I don't know if people know what that means out there in the world, but idiomatic tends to mean well written for the performers chosen or the instruments chosen. So if something really works well for choir, it's because it's working well for the individual vocal parts.
Sure. And so somebody writing for trombone, for example, would, as in the piece that we are playing for the concert on the 22nd, there's a lot of glissandos and things that lie well for trombone. So that would be idiomatic. Yes.
That's a few people who are coming, but there's not going to be on any one particular concert the same kind of music back to back.
Right. And I also know that the gentleman who composed the piece that we're playing is quite young, but you also have students represented, do you not?
We have a couple, well, we have some graduate students represented. I'm actually playing a solo clarinet piece by a graduate student. He's actually from Maine, but he's now staying in Florida. And it's a really cool piece, and it has what we call multiphonics in it. So this is more experimental. So I'm playing a clarinet, which usually plays one note at a time. But in his piece, I play chords.
Do you sing? Is it homophonics, what we used?
No, it's actually it's trick fingerings that you can force into playing actual chords.
Wow. That is a trick. That's difficult. What actually goes into writing a piece of new, never before heard music? And what are some of the skills composers must master before they can present new music to the world?
Well, again, if they're hoping to write for other people to perform their work, they obviously have to know what music notation is supposed to give that performer in terms of information. So they have to be able to read music pretty well and then get used to writing it. Nowadays, everyone uses a software package to notate their scores. So the idea of using pen and ink, it still exists in the world, and certainly people often sketch that way. But in terms of making the final product that you would hand to a musician, you'd actually have to figure out which software package you're going to learn and then learn it well so that you don't wind up having illegible scores and that kind of stuff. So that's just very practical. A lot of people would say you have to know at least the basics of what we call music theory. And it's an unfortunate name, music theory. It's not theory. It's sort of like traditional grammar. So it really is like, okay, so these harmonies go well together traditionally. You don't have to limit yourself to these harmonies, but if you want to sound traditional or even use that as a way of sort of like getting some inspiration and moving away from it and back to it and away from it and back to it, it's a way of starting out with something that we know works. So if you know that grammar, and people learn the grammar different ways. Some people learn the grammar by ear. But then, if you want to again have it played by other people, you have to have some way of having that grammar be represented in a way that other people can read it. So, music theory of different kinds, and there's actually, just like I was talking about, there's genres within contemporary music for these kind of ensembles. There's also genres within like studying music theory. You can study a way to write Bach style music. And you could say that that would be good practice, but not everybody's going to find it really inspiring, right? That might be a specialty thing. But if you want to learn to write things that have a recognizable form, so for instance, just even writing a piece that has a chorus and a verse, how is the chorus going to be different than the verses? Or is it just going to be verse one, verse two, verse three, verse four? All that kind of thing comes from the musical grammar that you use.
And understanding also those idioms you referenced earlier. So, and then the musicians themselves have to get the parts and then they have to rehearse them. And so it's quite a long road before you get to the actual festival.
Yes,
And
yes.
speaking of which, can you tell our Creative Maine listeners how they can access this festival? I assume it's open to the public for.
It
Yes, are there tickets provided? Do you what are some of the pertinent details?
Sure, there's no tickets necessary. They're all going to be free and open to the public. So you can come to Minsky Recital Hall at the University of Maine within the Class of 1944 Hall. For some people, it's good to tell them that it's next to this Collins Center for the Arts, an attached building. And Minsky Recital Hall is on the first floor. We have three concerts on February 21st, which are at 12:30, 3:30, and 7:30. And then on February 22nd, we have another concert at 12:30, another one at 4, and again, the last one at 7:30. So there's three concerts each day. There are obviously going to be composers in the audience, along with some students and faculty, and we hope other people join us. What will happen is we're also going to stream it. So each concert will be streamed on the YouTube channel that belongs to the School of Performing Arts.
But you could go to the University of Maine School of
University
Performing Arts.
of Performing Arts website and follow it there.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on with me. I think this was a very interesting discussion, and I hope to catch up with you on another occasion to talk about other interesting topics. But I really appreciate your coming on with me today, Dr. Beth Wieman, and we look forward to seeing you at the SCI Festival at the University of Maine in February. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome, Chantal Harris, to Creative Maine. You are the director of Monson Arts. Can you tell us what Monson Arts is, and it's an artist residency program, I know that. So maybe define what an artist residency program is as well.
Absolutely. Monson Arts is an art center and residency program, education programs, and workshops. The artist residency portion is our core programming, and a residency is, there's a lot of models of residencies, but the core is time and space, giving artists of all types. In our case, we have writers and visual artists coming to Monson, and we give them a studio, we give them a home, a shared home, in private bedrooms and provide food so that they can just focus on making.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. How about you? Tell us a little bit about yourself and your creative journey. How do you come to be in this position at Monson Arts?
It was a wandering path. I went to art school. I studied sculpture and installation art at the School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. And I didn't know what a residency was. I knew about some, the efforts of getting into galleries and whatnot. And my first job was working at a frame shop, getting to know artists, making their frames, working with the museums and galleries in Boston, doing installations. From there, I went to work at Emmanuel College, and they had an artist residency program. I was running the art department and at the same time started helping with the residency program and very quickly learned that it was a skill set I had for organizing, communicating, getting the applications in order, and then welcoming the artists and really supporting their time, getting them acquainted with living in Boston for the summer. And as that went on, I worked there for about 10 years. I realized I really wanted to dive deep into the residency world and found myself in Monson.
That's great. So, what's the history of Monson Arts? You have quite a program. It's sort of a three-pronged effort, as I understand it. So tell us about how Monson Arts came to be. Where is it? What is three parts of the program?
So Monson was established by the Libra Foundation, which is a philanthropical organization in Maine. They support agriculture, outdoor recreation, and the arts. Up until Monson Arts, their arts programming was less deeply connected to their organizations. So Monson Arts was established under that umbrella vision. We are located in Piscataquis County, which was an area that Libra hadn't been working in yet. They have projects in other counties, in every other county in Maine. This project was the first big dive into supporting artists. We are located just below the 100-mile wilderness of the Appalachian Trail. North of us is the woods. It is a lot of logging companies and campsites and lakes. We are, as you look at a map, we're at the edge of the main road. So it is this beautiful expanse of being in nature. At the same time, we're in a tiny little town. And one of the primary reasons that Libra chose Monson was that it was having an economic downfall with the closure of Moosehead Manufacturing, which was a furniture company that had employed over 200 people in the region. Say that Monson is a town of 650 people, so it employs quite a bit.
Yeah, that's significant. So what year did Libra start investing in Monson?
The investments began in 2017, and we were running programs in 2018.
Wow, that's pretty recent. That's
Yes.
pretty recent. So tell us about that three-part program.
So we have the residencies that reach artists worldwide. We have education programming that focuses with our area high schools, our middle schools, and our local adult population. We have community programs that offer one-day opportunities, as well as week-long workshops over the summer.
And you have a gallery too, right?
Yes. We also have the gallery, which highlights local artists. We currently have an artist who lives about three doors down from the gallery, a wonderful painter who has been connected to Monson for over 20 years. And we've exhibited Wabanaki artists. We've exhibited Bernice Abbott, who was a photographer based mainly out of New York City, but her summer home and her last 20 years of her life were spent in Monson.
Oh, so for a teeny weeny little town, there's a lot of art that goes on there.
Yes.
So, what kind of people come to the residency? You said they're international writers and visual artists mostly, right? So, are these young, old? What kind of people are they?
So we have 10 spaces for each residency. We're running 9 residencies a year. And for each session, there'll be 10 artists. 5 of them are under the category of writers, and 5 of them are under the category of visual arts. However, there's a lot of flexibility. I've had musicians, I've had audio storytellers, I've had sound artists, I have had sculptors, furniture makers, painters, photographers. We actually have a photography partnership with a local photographer named Todd Watts, who runs our Abbott Watts photo category. But within this range of many genres, we welcome people who are in their first year of getting out of school, coming into the wider art world, folks who have been doing it for many years and are, deeply in their painting careers, and brand new emerging artists in their 70s who switched careers.
That's great.
One of the benefits of our open call process is that when you apply, we're inviting everyone to apply. It's not a narrowed selective invitation process.
So, what are some of the criteria for acceptance into Monson Arts residency program?
We're looking for people who have that need for time and space. We don't have a heavy equipment load. We have a small wood shop and a metal shop, but we don't have things like a print studio or a ceramic studio, although there is a ceramicist in the community as well. So when we're evaluating, and we have different jurors evaluate every season, so there's 3 open calls per year. Those different jurors are looking at things that excite them, works that they haven't seen before, and it's a fairly simple application. We ask for a few samples of work and then a letter of intent. And that letter of intent is where we're trying to hear why you need this space and why Maine specifically would be helpful.
What are some of the qu answers to that question that you get? Why Maine?
I can think of one example where somebody was writing a story about hiking in, I believe it was hiking in Iceland, and they wanted to come here in the winter to feel the cold and kind of be in that character's environment while they were writing, which was a really very specific experience to draw on. But also just getting away from the city. I have 4 people from Brooklyn in my last session. Just being able to not see tall buildings everywhere you look is also a good reason to want to come to Monson.
I think that's a great reason. So, do you have any examples of projects that have resulted from residencies? People come to get away from it all and to experience life adjacent to the woods.
There are so many projects. We've had over 500 artists come through since 2018. I've had a few people come back and to lead workshops. We are working as a town. We're working with one of our former artists on bringing some large-scale sculptures to the downtown area. And when I say downtown area, it's about a quarter mile long. It's a very small town. But to have these large sculptures right in the middle of our town, and being able to have that connection because of the residency program is pretty incredible that they asked us to be the town.
That's great. It makes Monson a destination for people seeking art, potentially.
That is our hope.
Yeah, that's great. So, what makes Monson Arts different from other residencies? What is your definition of an artist? So, I know that at the turn of the 20th century, for example, the definition of an artist was someone who paints or sculpts, but it's changed. I know it's changed.
Absolutely. My definition of an artist is someone who puts passion into their creativity. And we have absolutely had artists who would not necessarily call themselves a professional artist because maybe they haven't had their book published yet or sold their work yet, but they are working on it and they're deeply invested in it, and the type of creativity is widely spanning. We've had journalists and researchers come in residencies to support their projects, and it is easy to see sculpture and painting and know that that is art. It's a lot harder to see performance art in that capacity. We've also had performance artists, dancers, and movement-based work.
Do you draw a line between craft and art?
We've had some people who you might put in the craft category. We've had furniture makers. We have had textile artists working in on whether it's a wall-based textile piece or a wearable piece. Those lines are often very blurry, especially for me. I see the value of that creative work. What if your hand is involved in making something, it's an artist's work.
But it has to be your own work, not something you recreate. So, for example, I like to do a lot of fiber crafts. So I can follow somebody else's pattern for a sweater. That doesn't make me an artist. But would you call a designer an artist?
I would. I think designers are artists. Yep. And mimicry to learning from other people's patterns is, the first step for many artists.
I know that. Back in, say, the 19th century, people used to, or even the 18th century, people used to go to the Louvre and just copy paintings to learn. So I can see where that would be the first step to your own creativity. So, can you tell our Creative Maine listeners how they can find Monson Arts and become involved or even apply for their own residency?
We have a lovely website, monsonarts.org, that will share all the information on how you can apply for a open call. We just closed our spring session, so the next open call will be April 1st through May 15th for fall residencies. We are in the process of announcing our workshop schedule. Those will also be on the website.
That's exciting.
And coming to visit Monson, we're smack dab in the middle of Maine, up Route 15.
I
Gallery.
forgot to ask you, how long is a residency?
Oh, they're either 2 weeks or 4 weeks.
Wow, 4 weeks is substantial.
Yep.
So if you apply for a residency, you have to really set aside a chunk of time in order
Yes.
to really appreciate it.
Yeah. And most people are able to be flexible with their schedules, whether they can take time off. The 2 week ones are in a bit more demand as it's easier to take 2 weeks away. But we've had no lack of people able to come to the 4 week sessions.
Yes, we want to go to Monson. We want to see your gallery. Are the artworks in the gallery for sale?
They are. Roberta Weaver Jarvis is our current artist on exhibition. She is a Monson local, a painter for many years, and her works, there's a mixture of works from her early years and recently painted works available for sale.
And the exhibition is up through when?
It's up through April 20th.
And it's called These Complicated Woods. I love that. I love that. So, Roberta Weaver Jarvis is the featured artist, a local. That's amazing. So, it's really how Monson Arts gives back to its community and has a presence in its community. So, you're of the community.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. It's a wonderful time in the life of Monson Arts. It's still new, and I wish you all the best luck, and I look forward to coming up to Monson and visiting you.
Thank you so much. I look forward to having you.
Creative Maine is alive with activities, presentations, workshops, concerts, and all manner of cultural endeavors. At this point in the show, we highlight a few of the many calendar items going on around the region. Today, we highlight some places to find winter fun you can enjoy warmly. On February 21st and 22nd, the Society of Composers, hosted by the University of Maine, presents 6 concerts featuring the creativity of contemporary music composers from around our region. All concerts take place at the University of Maine School of Performing Arts in Orono and can be enjoyed both in person and streaming online through the University of Maine School of Performing Arts website, umaine.edu/SPA. For more information, visit umaine.edu/SPA. Join the Pajebscot History Center virtually on February 27th at 6 p.m. for a Black History Month special presentation, Maine and New England's Black Sailors, a talk given by Seth Goldstein from the South Portland Historical Society. To register for the free Zoom link, visit pajebscothistorical.org. Maine is home to many wonderful museums and galleries that offer a wealth of indoor arts experiences. One such is the Monson Arts Gallery, which celebrates the creative heritage of Maine by hosting a wide variety of exhibitions featuring local artists past and present. These complicated woods, the works of Monson artist Roberta Weaver Jarvis, is on view at the gallery through April 20, 2025. The Monson Arts Gallery is located at 8 Greenville Road, Monson, Maine, and is open Friday and Saturday 12 to 5 and Sundays 12 to 3. For a more complete listing of events, visit our website, weru.org, and click the Community Calendar tab. If you would like to add an item to the community calendar, you may follow the prompts on the calendar page and submit your own event for the list. If you have an event that you feel is particularly pertinent to Creative Maine, send a note with the details to info@weru.org and list Creative Maine in the subject line. You are listening to Creative Maine on WERU 89.9 FM and on WERU.org and on the cell phone app. Next, we speak with Mark Mushaw, the executive director of Hewn Oaks. Mark Mushaw, welcome to Creative Maine. I'm so glad that you're here. You are the director of Hewn Oaks, and our episode today is all about the encouragement and highlighting of emerging artists. And so I think Hewn Oaks fits beautifully into that. So tell me, what is Hewn Oaks? What is an artist residency program?
Well, thanks, Adina. Thank you so much for inviting me to join you today. I'm flattered by the opportunity to have a captive audience to evangelize about Hewn Oaks, too. Hewn Oaks is, in very basic terms, a summer artist residency in Western Maine. We're located in the town of Lovell. We overlook this glorious lake called Keyser Lake. And, you know, there are vistas framed by the White Mountains in the distance. You know, the property itself is this incredible time capsule. You know, it's 120 years old. It's an arts and crafts era arts center in this really funky Tudor revival architectural style. And it served as a place of retreat for artists for the entirety of that span of time since the turn of the century. We currently support about 45 to 60 artists across all career stages and disciplines every summer, and we provide them 1 to 2 week long, fully subsidized residencies in our cabins. And, you know, the residency season runs from early June to early October. So as to your second question, what is an artist residency? I guess in the most generic terms, you could say that an artist residency is simply a workplace for artists. There are innumerable varieties of artist residency. There are all kinds of different structures and offerings and durations, but really the common denominators are a sense of sanctuary, privacy for artists to be among artists. Accommodations, residencies are essentially modified bed and breakfasts for creative practitioners. They can run anywhere from a week to several months. Actually, there are programs that are years long. And, you often find them in idyllic places that afford this rejuvenating change of scenery where artists can really kind of get away from it all and blot out the din of modernity. Many artist residencies have fabrication facilities, studio spaces, media labs. It's a really just a kind of full immersion environment where you're insulated from the distractions of, your workaday life, where you are, have the pressures and burdens of day jobs and family responsibilities lifted from you, and where you can connect with fellow artists, new cohorts, and have a dialogue that transcends geographic boundaries and disciplinary boundaries. It's a place where you can really go to explore and experiment. And, I think last of all, I'd really want to emphasize that they're really essential spaces in the cultural ecosystem. They're kind of the spawning ground of new work. And if you value going into museums and being transported by original and innovative contemporary work, if you value pulling a book off the shelf and being deeply affected by it, you should be a supporter of the work that artist residencies do, because without spaces like this, I think our cultural capital would be much more threadbare.
That's a beautiful way to put it. You paint a wonderful picture, and I want to go. So tell me about yourself. Tell us about your own creative journey and how you came to be in this position at Hewn Oaks.
Sure. Well, I'm a writer, currently a resting writer, I guess you would say. The administrative work that I do has really kind of eclipsed my creative career. But, the first residency I ever went to was in 2007. I went to a place called Civitella Ranieri in a 15th century castle in Umbria, Italy. It's a pretty fantastical setting to be in. I've heard people refer to it as Disney World for artists. And it was, a pretty heady start to my lifelong love affair with artist residencies. Without getting overly biographical here, I think, I moved around a lot as a kid, was yanked around from one country to another, and I think I found in a residency what I'd always found in every new school that I started in, which is that, I always gravitated to other artsy misfits every time I changed places. And residencies are really kind of that gathering place for other artsy misfits, people who are, cursed or blessed with the creative drive, where you can sort of gather around with others like you who are excited by the same things as you, who are interested in ideas and making interesting work, and you all speak this kind of common language. So it's a family that you find yourselves admitted into. So as a writer, I've been to many different residencies over the years, and actually, my admiration for the work that they do grew and grew. And Civitella ended up offering me a job to run their administrative headquarters in New York City. And right before I took that job, I attended Hewn Oaks. This was the summer of 2015. I had known about Hewn Oaks because my good friend and one of the, somebody who's really done more for the arts and culture sector in Maine than just about anyone, Nat May, who is the former director of Space Gallery, the founding director of Space Gallery in Portland. I knew he was involved, and that told me that Hewn Oaks would be a place that really thoughtfully centered the needs of artists. And indeed, the moment I showed up there, I felt completely seduced by the place, really bewitched by it. I mean, it's stunningly beautiful, and the human landscape is every bit as inviting as the physical landscape. There's a real sense of warmth and welcome, and acceptance and solidarity and support that you get from your fellow artists there. And it was just really kind of like slipping into this warm bath of easy camaraderie. And the hook was set. I left there immediately plotting a return visit. And I didn't imagine that that return visit would actually not take place until 2019, when I was invited onto the board of HUNOCS by Nat, who at that point was the executive director of HUNOCS. About a year later, COVID struck, Nat stepped away from the organization, and I decided to offer up my services to take the tiller for a little while as interim director. And it was not long after that I went from that kind of caretaker position to full director, and was really just so compelled by what the organization was doing and trying to accomplish. And it's been a great ride, and I'm so lucky to work with a really dedicated board and staff.
That sounds wonderful. You paint a gorgeous picture, and congratulations, I think, maybe. So you mentioned that HUNOCS is 120 years old, roughly. Can you describe the history of it? And how has the concept of an artist retreat changed over that century and change? I've been to a couple of residency programs myself. The McDowell Colony is one for mostly, I heard about it in terms of musicians. And I myself attended Banff Center for the Arts. I had a residency there with a brass quintet one summer, which was, it was also amazing and gorgeous. So tell me a little bit about the concept of an artist retreat, the history of HUNOCS, and has the definition of what an artist is changed over time since the inception of HUNOCS?
All really, really good questions. And congratulations on your residency at Banff. And, your mention of McDowell is really apropos, because that's the OG residency. That really was the one that set the template for all other residencies in the US to emulate. And in fact, it's kind of a coeval of HUNOCS. It was born of the same era. It came about, I think McDowell was founded in 1907, just, a few years after HUNOCS, actually.
Mm.
The history of HUNOCS, as you alluded to, it's this really fascinating and many-layered history. We're doing our best to honor it by perpetuating that tradition of hospitality to artists. It was originally the summer retreat of artists Douglas and Marion Larrabee Volk. They were New Yorkers and kind of kept rarefied company and in Gilded Age New York, very gregarious and well-connected artists. Douglas himself was the scion of kind of this illustrious line of artists. His father was an accomplished sculptor. He, Douglas, was himself a pretty renowned painter at the time. Marion was also a creative spirit and actually founded the Sabattis rug weaving industry at HUNOCS and produced these wonderful hand-hooked, naturally dyed rugs that have become these really sought-after art historical artifacts. The Metropolitan Museum of Art and Smithsonian have a couple in their collection. But I think the really important thing to emphasize is that, being gregarious and being well-connected and being really in the mix of the art world, the Volks started inviting their friends, their artist friends, to the property to use it as, an informal place of retreat, a place to do their work. And some really astounding luminaries of the era ended up spending time there. So, you have people like William Merritt Chase and Frank Benson and Childe Hassam, these bold-faced names of late Impressionism. It's said that Marsden Hartley had spent some time at HUNOCS and early in his career. John Calvin Stevens, the architect, any number of other artists as well. So there was always this really powerful ferment of interdisciplinary artistic activity at HUNOCS. And the property, as I mentioned before, it's this real time capsule. I've heard people refer to it as Maine's answer to the Hudson River School. It contained this stunning hoard of art that artists left there over time. HUNOCS underwent all kinds of different incarnations over the years. And, it was in 2005 that the last of the Volk bloodline, Jesse Volk, bequeathed the property to the University of Maine Foundation with the stipulation, interestingly, that it be used for the study and promotion of the arts. So UMaine Foundation offered the use of the property to, well, actually another nonprofit before Hugh Noakes was founded, but they brought together a group of people who had been associated with space to develop a residency program that would make use of the property. And I think it was 2012 that the first group of artists came along. It was just a handful of artists. And based on the success of that pilot year, the residency was kind of formalized and incorporated as a nonprofit in 2013. And we've been in continuous operation ever since, with the exception of summer 2020. And we've served about 100, oh, sorry, 450 artists during that
Wow.
time.
Well, I am very curious what the definition of an artist has been as opposed to what it is now. Is it the same thing? What do you define artist as?
Oh, I think it has dramatically changed. I think fine arts really, initially an artist was, I think, particularly back then, considered to be a painter. That's certainly the primacy of painting in the art. The whole sort of full spectrum of art production has waned. And the notion of arts being a pursuit for the aristocratic classes, I think that has changed as well. These days, I think you find artists who are working at the intersections of disciplines much more than might have been the case even 10, 20, 30 years ago, let alone 120 years. You find artists who are working in emerging mediums, non-traditional mediums. There's a lot more interest in, for instance, sound as a sculptural medium, sound art. I think just the definition of an artist has grown and expanded, and more forms of creative practice fall under that rubric. There's a lot of podcasting now that I think is very justifiably considered an art form. I think art has just become much more sort of synthetic. In the sense of, there being all of these interdisciplinary syntheses, it's much harder to pin down. There's a lot of art that an art admirer in 1900 would, if they were presented with it today, they would not recognize it as art, conceptual art, performance art. There's just been a real sort of expansiveness in the definition of artist. And it's also become, I think, a much more pluralistic and inclusive field of human endeavor.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
So I have one more question is what makes Hugh Noakes different from other such residency and retreat programs in Maine?
Well, there are a few different differentiators. I would say that, there's been this really long tradition of artists coming to Maine to rusticate for the summer months, to enjoy the benign weather and drink in the, beauty of it all. And then they scatter hither and yon wherever they've come from without contributing all that much to Maine's artistic landscape. So that's one reason why we give preference to Maine artists. We reserve about 75% of our capacity for Maine artists, since so many of the residencies in this state are largely inaccessible to Mainers. That's for a variety of reasons, but one of them is that most Maine artists just lack the institutional support or the abundant funding that artists, say, from New York might enjoy.
Sure. Okay, so what's next for Hugh Noakes? What's coming up?
Obviously, we're going to continue advancing our mission of fostering the professional development and artistic growth of creative practitioners of all kinds. But and you know, we're also really, really committed to preserving this piece of Maine's cultural heritage that's been undocumented and little studied. And we have this remarkable opportunity in front of us to preserve this wondrous organization and these wondrous buildings. The University of Maine Foundation has actually made us the stunningly generous offer to donate the property to our nonprofit. I can't even fathom what its fair market value is, but it's a very valuable piece of property. So this is a really generous offer. And we're tasked with basically matching that donation by raising money to restore, repair, and make capital improvements to the property to ensure that it's going to stand for another 120 years and it's endowed so that its care and maintenance will be seen to in perpetuity.
Wow. So tell our Creative Maine listeners how they can find Hewn Oaks, maybe contribute to the cause, become involved one way or another, or even apply for their own residency. Where would they find you?
As it happens, we're right in the middle of our application process right now for 2025 residencies. So if listeners would like to learn more about the program and apply themselves, I'd certainly steer them towards our website, hewnoaks.org, that you'll find a link to our application there. You know, that's certainly the best place to learn about the history. And if you care to support the work that we're doing, we believe it's very important. We hope you do too. We also have a donation portal on that page.
Excellent. Well, Mark Muschaw, it's been a real pleasure. I've learned a lot, and I hope our listeners have too. And good luck with the next chapter of Hewn Oaks. You have quite a task in front of you, but I'm very grateful that you could come on and speak with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your time, Adina. And yes, great respect to you as well for the important work that you're doing in support of arts and culture too.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much to my interesting and informative guests, Beth Wieman, Chantal Harris, and Mark Muschaw. Our theme music is composed and performed by Ariel Chapman, with additional music by Richard Nelson. If you have questions or comments for me or any of our guests, please send them to info@weru.org. Please write Creative Maine in the subject line. Please join Creative Maine at WERU 89.9 FM or on weru.org for another eclectic episode on Thursday, March 20th at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, when we will learn about the Maine Made gift shop phenomenon. Thank you so much for listening. This is Adina Salmonson wishing you a wonderful month of the arts and crafts that enrich your life and bring you joy.